Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today, we're catching up with Finley Wild, who holds the unsupported FKT on the Paddy Buckley round in Snowdonia, Wales. Join us to learn about what it's like to break a supported effort unsupported and about his connection to the mountains. Well, Finley, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the show today. I'm really looking forward to chatting with you.
Cheers, Heather. Thanks very much for having me on.
You've had a really successful year in 2022, and I think the main thing we want to talk about is all the way back in April, and you set a pretty decisive FKT on the Paddy Buckley round in Wales. And it was really stunning to me in several ways. And the first is the round itself. So I was wondering if you could describe the aesthetic of the route and also what makes the Paddy Buckley so challenging.
Yeah, it's a really great round. It's one of the what's become known as the Big Three in Britain. So it's the Welsh, the classic Welsh sort of 100-kilometer round. It's in Snowdonia, in north of Wales, which are just great mountains. A relatively small mountain area, but just really varied. You've got some really rough, scrambly stuff. You've got grassy, rolling hills. Quite a few bogs and unpathed, pathless climbs and areas, but you've also got quite a real rich sort of cultural history. It's a mining area, so there's various kind of cultural archaeological kind of sites where there's old mines basically, and you actually run through one of them or a couple of them actually during the route. So yeah, it's a really varied area, and it's a tough round. It's a great 100k with 8,000 and something meters of ascent.
When you say it's really varied terrain, is there anything really technical, like scrambling, where you have to use your hands, or is it all pretty straightforward?
There's not really official scrambling. There's one mountain called Tryfan, which has you would use your hands a bit, particularly if you're taking the fastest kind of most direct lines. And it has a really rough descent off it where you probably use your hands on the descent, sort of catching yourself. So there's no sort of, I suppose, graded scrambling, but there's certainly scrambly sections.
Yeah. So definitely kind of requires a wide variety of skills.
Yeah. So that contrast with then some really fast, smooth running on sort of well-defined mountain tracks on undulating grassy ridges where you can really get a good speed up, and there's not much road. There's a tiny section of road after one descent before you get to another one, but there is a little bit of we'd call it a forestry track, like vehicle tracks low down in some of the valleys.
So the second thing that I found super impressive about your time was that you took over an hour off of the previous FKT, which was supported, and you did this completely unsupported. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, like setting that record, but also just like why you chose unsupported.
I was gaining confidence. I'd done the Charlie Ramsay round, which is the sort of Scottish classic round in 2020. And then the Bob Graham in the Lake District in England in 2021. It was like only a matter of time before I wanted to try and complete the set, as it were, and get the third one. So I was gaining confidence with how I could move on these. In the Ramsay's round in Scotland, I decided to do that solo unsupported, kind of for a mixture of reasons, which are the same with the Paddy Buckley. It's just easier. You don't have to plan for anyone else. You don't have to arrange dates or support. Also, I just really like the simple aesthetic of just, going out and, obviously I'd recce'd and got to know everything, the route, and have a think about my kind of personal logistics. But then it's just really simple. You go out, you choose the day when the weather looks good, and off you go. And it's sort of the full test of yourself. You're doing everything. You're doing the navigation, the pacing, and the fueling, obviously the carrying the kit. So I do kind of like that self-sufficiency and the simplicity of it. There were a few other factors, particularly in Scotland when I did the Ramsay's round. it's actually pretty remote and it's quite hard to get support in. So it would have, and the weather in Scotland, I live up near the Ramsey Round, and formerly the weather isn't always so good. So if you,
right.
Yeah. So if you plan, say a weekend or a couple of weekends in a row and have support organized, and then the weather isn't good on either of those, I think people sometimes feel themselves pushed into going when the weather's suboptimal. But really, for a fast ride, you want near optimal weather, you know. Now, there's a load of reasons why people would just go with what weather they've got. You know, people have got time booked off work and busy lives doing other things. But I wanted to devote a bit more time to it so that I could go when the weather was good. So yeah, same in for the Paddy, the Bob Graham was fully supported, so that was a totally different experience itself. But for the Paddy Buckley, down in Wales, a pretty rough round, I was reasonably confident that I should be able to get near to the record, even unsupported. It was no way a given, but I was reasonably confident. So I kind of like that challenge. Again, the simplicity, the aesthetic of it, but just the ease of organizing, mainly.
One of the things I thought was interesting was your rather unremarkable start and end point at a bus stop. How did you choose your start and end point? Is that the common place to start and end the Paddy Buckley, or was there some other reason for choosing this inauspicious location?
No, that's a good point, because most rounds, of course, have a very defined start and finish point. The Bob Graham round in the lakes has got the Moot Hall, which is this lovely old sort of tower in the middle of a lovely, beautiful Lakeland town. And so it makes for good pictures and things. Up in the Scottish one and the Ramsays round, it tends to be a youth hostel in Glen Nevis, which is a very, you know, definite point. But for the Paddy Buckley round, there's sort of less of a defined start and finish as long as you complete the loop, which I like that aesthetic. You know, it doesn't have to be a specific point. As long as you do the mountains and do the loop, close the loop, it can start and finish anywhere. And people do tend to vary that. So there's a couple of valleys that are the most common ones. So Clonbarris, where I started and finished, is probably the commonest, but also Capel Curig at the east end is fairly common to start and finish. And I think there's pros and cons to different approaches in terms of how you, where you get to the different terrain in your round. So whether you're fresh or tired, but also what time of day it is and how much light you've got. How much light, I suppose, is a bit less of an issue on a fast round in the summer, because I had a head torch for the first hour or something, and then I was in the daylight the whole time. Whereas if it was a 24-hour round, you're in the dark for a lot longer. So you basically choose wherever you're going to have your start and finish point. So a few things, like Clonbarris, I was actually staying with a friend there, so logistically it was pretty easy, because you're obviously getting up early and starting early, which is nice to be able to walk out the door and go down to the centre. And also doing it that way meant that you do one of the rougher sections, the Glidders, first, when you're nice and fresh. And then the second section is quite relatively smooth. And the third section is this long, quite potentially quite tiring section that's quite undulating and sometimes a bit boggy, with some not hard navigation, but the peaks are a bit less defined. So you have to be really on it. And I wanted to do that. So that would be about just before halfway, I'd be doing that. And then it meant that the final section I would be doing off Snowdon and then down to the end was quite a runnable, well-defined track. So I thought that would work quite well for me. So yeah, that's kind of why I chose that point. And why I chose the bus stop really was, there's not, obviously you want the shortest line you can. So that was the sort of the area in town really where the line of the route cross town, so there wasn't anything kind of much more iconic or anything there, so I didn't I didn't put on any extra mileage. I could have gone to, there's a famous climbers cafe called Pete's Eats, which does huge cups of tea, which we love our tea in Britain, obviously.
Right.
But that would have, yeah, that would have made it a bit longer, maybe a kilometer longer. So yeah, wouldn't be doing that.
I loved your finish photo. You're just like laying on the pavement, like all muddy and sweaty and obviously very tired and just at this bus stop. And did anybody walk by and ask you what you'd been up to? Or, you know, is it a common sight here in town? Are they used to people like doing this?
I mean, it's quite a mountain town, so they definitely will be used to seeing all sorts of, runners and climbers and swimmers and people doing odd things. It was solo unsupported by my friends. Knew, you know, sort of I was going for the record and had an idea of what time I'd be finishing. So there were half a dozen people at the finish there when I came in, which was really nice to see. So I think I said in my write up that on these big runs, the sort of when you finish the kind of euphoria is first like stopping running, because you've obviously been thinking about the end for several hours, and just to stop running is nice. And then it's sitting down, and then it's maybe getting a cup of tea, which one of them had brought, and then it's sort of savoring the record. So it's like the human comfort. It's like first is stopping and then relaxing and then thinking about, oh, okay, new record.
Yeah, there's a progression to it for sure. I finished a lot of FKTs and usually the first 5 minutes, I'm just so glad I'm done, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's all I'm just glad I'm not moving.
which I think, people who don't do these long runs would think, well, why'd you do it if you're just thinking about finishing? But
right.
It's a great feeling as well, because you've achieved this this big memorable day out you'll probably remember for the rest of your life, and it's been really tough in the latter stages. So yeah, finishing is so rewarding. I guess that's part of the allure of these big challenges, is that they make the little things like stopping running, having a cup of tea, having a shower, you know, these things, they make them the luxuries of life seem all the better.
Absolutely. You appreciate everything so much more. I was part of why I asked about whether you got any interesting looks or commentary from passersby, is I was in Scotland this last summer doing a lot of backpacking. And in the US, you usually get a lot of commentary if you're just like sitting around town dirty and muddy and with a backpack. And I like never experienced that in Scotland. Like everyone was just like, nobody even looked at me twice. Like they're just like, okay, it's normal. So I was just curious, because it's so different from the US to like what I experienced, how it just seems so normative to be in town,
yeah,
having done something in the mountains, you know, like clearly you were out, you know, mucking about in the mountains. Great. You know, like,
I mean, you would get comments often by walkers when you're out in the hill, you know, well done, or where are you going?
Right.
Or certainly runners, you know, would see you on the route and probably realize you might be on for a paddy, say, particularly if you looked, you know, absolutely trashed and knackered.
Right.
But yeah, maybe people would be less likely to just sort of come up to you in the town at the end and start sort of chatting. We're maybe a bit less confident about that kind of thing than your typical American, maybe.
I definitely feel like the attention you get in town in America is not necessarily positive. So it's so that all that aside. So I'm kind of curious if you have like maybe like the iconic story, like what will you take with you forever from the Paddy Buckley? Like, I mean, whether it's like a cool thing you experienced out there or just something you learned about yourself, like what will the Paddy Buckley always mean to you?
Yeah, when I'm thinking about it now, I guess one of the things I love about mountain running, one of the main things about these sort of intense experiences, is that you you have these sort of snatched views and memories. You're not stopping and looking at the view the same way as a walker might, but you still have these memories, which are, I think, all the better and all the more intense because you were sort of a moving element in the landscape. And maybe there's something sort of primal there, something animalistic almost about, you weren't just looking at it from a plane window, say, you were an animal using its body to move and exist and survive, I suppose, because it's tough to survive in this landscape, this beautiful landscape, this natural landscape. So I have memories of like coming up onto the first hill and the second or third hill when the sunrise was up and I could kind of, it was quite a subdued sunrise, but I could see the hills that I was going to be on in, 45 minutes and then, in an hour and then in 3 hours, kind of glimpse these and I sort of steel myself towards the challenges ahead. And then, later on, like the scrambly bit on Tofan, like that's a great memory that it has two summit blocks, which get called Adam and Eve, which are, sort of 8 foot high with, I don't know, 4 foot in between them maybe. And so to gain the freedom of Trifan, you jump between these two blocks. And it's pretty exposed. And not everyone does it, but I sort of definitely wanted that experience in my round. So remembering that. Also remembering further on, you go into a different slate area in what's called the Mullwinds. And that was an area where I did a short fell race about 7 years ago, where I was my first British Championship race that I won. And I actually became British champion for the first time that year. The second time being this year. So I had these great memories of that area, the whole, and was able to sort of relive some of that. And I love the fact that there's these layers of memories. So I covered a small amount of the same route, but could then remember a totally different race and a totally different day, years ago. I love how these layers build up on each other and sort of really help to connect you to a place in a deeper way. So memories like that. And then really in the second half, to be honest, I struggled quite a bit with nausea. So I do have quite a memory of just mentally having to manage that and it being really pretty tough. And, obviously not wanting to start being sick, but knowing that I need to keep fueling, keep drinking and quite keep eating. So a memory of that being tough, but ultimately managing to do that. And then, of course, as you get close to the very finish, that hardship sort of melts away because you're anticipating the finish so much and you are so close that you often get this sort of, well, not even a second wind, but a final wind, where, you speed up and you're really chasing the time. And this was shortly before sunset, actually, and just coming down off Mul Ilio, which is the final mountain, quite a runnable track down to Cumberis in front of me, this real traditional old mining town. And just knowing that I had it in the bag and just really having had another day that was, I suppose, memorable because it was long and tough, but unique and really varied. So hopefully that sort of answers it.
Yeah, I think that that's really lovely. Like you touched on a lot of really beautiful themes there too, that I think that a lot of us that love running in the mountains can resonate with. And it kind of makes me want to know a little bit like more. You mentioned earlier, how you used to do a lot of climbing before you became a runner. And they, so you've obviously had this like lifelong connection to the mountains. So I'm curious what your progression has been, like how you got into, the mountain running and maybe what your overall connection to the mountains is. Like, what does it mean to you to be out there. Maybe it's the same as what you were just talking about, but I would be curious if you could talk a little more about that.
Yeah, I was really lucky growing up. So I lived in a, pretty rural place in the Highlands of Scotland, King Ucie, and then in Fort William, where I live now. I went to school here. And my parents, they love the mountains. My dad's a retired mountain guide. My mum was a really good hill runner in her day. So I guess growing up, it was always exposed to that, walks, but also just being out and, climbing trees and building huts and all those kind of things. So it was quite a kind of wild childhood where, you were out often just kind of doing your own thing with some friends, building gang huts and riding your bikes around with no real kind of structure. And then, of course, I was taking, climbing and up hills and things at a young age. And I was in the Scouts, which I feel was a really good good opportunity just to kind of explore that some more. So you're camping and building fires and just, again, getting comfortable in outdoor places. So I didn't really know any different, contrasting that maybe to someone who's grown up in the inner city somewhere, a big city, who I think, the outdoors can be quite daunting to them initially. But I didn't really know any difference. So I obviously had a big head start in that regard. And then, sort of convinced my dad to teach me more climbing. Wasn't really ever sort of pushed into it, but convinced him to show us some leading and other things. And then, at university, I went to Aberdeen on the east coast of Scotland for medical school. And there's a climbing group there called the Larrig Club. And just in there, we'd be away sort of every weekend and any other time we could, be either climbing wall or winter climbing on the kind of eastern Cairngorms a lot of the time. So that was sort of building my skills and my experience. And those were some really great days, mostly, climbing or walking. And then I did get into more running. I'd always ran a bit, but I got a bit more serious into my running, particularly on the days when the conditions were bad for climbing. And I'd just go off on my own and get some more Munros, which are the 4,000 foot peaks in Scotland. So building that up, and then gradually was doing more running, more racing. And over the years, now I do, still do some easy climbing, some scrambling, some alpine stuff, but mostly running, obviously. I suppose I was once asked, how do I fit running and mountain time in around doing a medical degree and then being a junior doctor and now a GP. And I gave some sort of waffly answer. And a month later, I suppose I thought of, I should have just said a simple answer that, I never wasn't going to have the mountains in my life. So everything else sort of had to fit around that. And I think I'd really still say that's true. They're like one of the most important things in my life, so I've structured life around that, living somewhere mountainous, having time to get out in the mountains. And, I suppose spare time is largely planned around training, yes, but also getting out on these great days out. So I just get such a lot of, I suppose, freedom from being out in the hills. I love the idea that it's not, let's say, there aren't really any rules. Obviously, there's sort of good practice, but essentially you can choose to interpret and do things the way you want to, as long as you're doing it in a respectful way. But also I love the headspace. Well, it's linked to freedom, the headspace to just unwind, and maybe you've had a busy day at work or whatever, and just you go out for a run. And I love how the mind sort of it fluctuates between maybe thinking about specific problems or specific tasks or things going on in your life, to then just after a few hours you'll just realize you haven't really been thinking about anything, or then you're busy thinking about your hands and your feet because there's a scrambly section or something like that. And I love how that just changes and fluctuates. And often, but so many times when I've been out for a run, I'll I'll be more inspired for tasks in other parts of my life. I'll have, right, I need to write a list of these things, and I've got more maybe ideas for projects or sort of creative things. So I feel like I'm the best version of myself when I'm running, or, you know, or at least when I have running and mountain time in my life. I feel that really helps me to be the best version of myself.
I resonate with that. Like, I feel like the mountains are of utmost importance to me, and I've always structured my life around my time there, which is very much the opposite of the way most people do it, you know? And so, I think that you put that very well. I noticed when I was, researching for this podcast, that you're also an artist and that you do a lot of artwork based off of your experiences in the mountains. And so I was kind of curious if you could talk a little bit about that. I think that that's a really interesting piece of information about your life and your personality.
Thanks. Yeah, that has been a really interesting period. I think, yeah, truthfully, it was a period, and I wouldn't say I'm active doing that, doing new pieces at the moment, but maybe that's something, and hopefully that's something I'll come back to in the future. But this was certainly a period of about, 5 years, partly started, I think, by some injuries where I was having less active time and more creative time at home. Because running, running is a form of, exercise can be really creative, can't it? You're deciding what to do. You're working out your own routes. So I suppose I was running less. I was a bit injured, and I was looking for other outlets. And anyway, so I had this great period of years when I was doing, just experimenting with color and designs, and my I'm not particularly trained as an artist or anything, and my paintings aren't particularly complex, but I loved the idea of trying to maybe get across to other people who know the mountains, the impression of a specific, well-known peak, just in a really simplified, kind of stylized way. So real bright colors, real bold sort of designs and thick lines. And some of them are, just really stylized, simplified. And it was really fun to see if I could make it something that I find recognizable, but also B, could anyone else kind of guess them? So, people seem to, I've had some great comments about them, and I sell some prints and things locally. And the art's on my website, which is gomountaingoats.com. But yeah, it's been a real fun project.
So what's next on your must explore list, maybe with regard to just personal exploration or races or FKTs?
Yeah, I feel like I haven't got any better at sort of pinning down these objectives. Like and I don't mind that, because the way that I sort of like them to seep into your mind gradually, and then suddenly you kind of know what you're going for. So at the moment, I'm hoping to be out in the Alps, in the French Alps, doing a lot of skimo racing and ski touring over the winter, but also very much looking to how can I sort of maximize my training to get me prepared for whatever it is I launch into to next year. So I would love to do some more long rounds. I'm not sure exactly what that'll be. I was when I did my Bob Graham round, I was very close to, I was about under seven minutes slower than Killian Journey's record at the time. And I was quite keen to go and have another look at that. And then Jack Kenzel has smashed that record, taking 29 minutes off Killian. So I would have 35 minutes or so to make up, to try and get close to Jack, which is a lot more than 7 minutes. So I don't know if I will feel ready for that, or when I'll feel ready for that, but that obviously, yeah, people have asked me about that, and it would be cool to try, but I'd need to be feeling pretty confident, I think, to put the effort in, because, you know, my attempt, when I did it before, it was a great day out, and I ran really hard and really well for myself. And, you know, there's a few things I could change, but so we'll see on that. But certainly the other one, Jack got my Tranter's record, which is in Le Cabre, so my local round. So I'd certainly want to have another look at that, see if I could edge that back.
That was my next question. When you mentioned Jack, I was like, you held that record for a day or your new record, and then Jack broke it.
Yeah, so I'd had the record. I first got it, I guess. I'd have to check. Maybe like 2016 or 2017, I first had it. But yeah, then I took times off it a couple of times. And the day before Jack went for his, I nudged it 7 minutes faster or something. And then Jack took a bit, 15 minutes off that time. So it was, it was absolutely great to meet Jack, and the whole process of him coming over and wrecking it and giving it loads of respect and time. And then just seeing someone, of that skill, of that talent, sort of being interested in this Tranter round, which doesn't get a huge amount of fast attempts, to be honest. So I really just enjoyed sort of sharing in the process and just in enjoying him enjoying it. So he definitely, delighted he came over and gave that attention. And now I've got him, an even bigger sort of incentive. It's quite hard sometimes racing yourself. But now, even more incentive to get back and see if I can improve and run faster, because ultimately that's... that's a great feeling if we're pushing each other, isn't it? As runners.
I am kind of curious. Did you know he was intending to go out like the next day when you went out? Like, you just wanted to make it just a little harder for him? Or was that completely coincidence?
So it's funny, because it wasn't complete coincidence. No, because he'd been in touch when he was planning to come over, and, I hadn't heard of him, I must admit. So it was a random American had texted me, had emailed me, and then he was, a few months later, he was like, oh, I'm here, I'm wrecking, it's great, blah, blah, blah. And then I think he wanted to get some shoes sent to my house, because he was just living in a van. So I needed to give him my address. And at that point, I thought, well, I better Google him and check he's, a real person.
Find out about this person.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, he's done some stuff. And then actually that same, afternoon we met, and we did just a short run on Ben Nevis, and we just clicked immediately and had great chat the whole way up and the whole way down. And I sort of said, well, look, so my previous record for Tranter's, was 9 hours and 5 seconds. So I obviously, when I was doing that record, I was trying really hard to get it under 9 hours, but I didn't quite get there. So I always had this thing that I wanted to go back and get it under nine. And I was thinking, before Jack was on the scene, that I'd like to go back and try and take a bit off that. Particularly this year, when I'd been probably mostly, well, after the Paddy Buckley in April, later on in the year, I did loads of shorter races and had a great year, actually. But probably my best year as a runner. But I've been doing mostly shorter stuff. So I was kind of curious to see how I would do with the Tranter ride, which is 60 kilometers, off the back of not tons of like distance specific training. So I was thinking about doing it. And I suppose the fact that Jack was around certainly focused the mind a bit. But also the... the weather, there had to be a bit varied weather. So there was this like couple of days, 2 or 3 days weather window coming up, and sort of, it was quite obvious that we were both kind of looking at it. And, I don't think either of us had sort of came out and said, right, I'm going on that day. I went out and had my go, and then, he saw it on Strava and had to do a last minute kind of calculation of all his split times and everything. But obviously then still went out and smashed it. So and it was a real fun part to the story as well, just how it was all happening so close.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
No, hey, it's always a privilege to be asked to talk about, you know, your own feats and, you know, stuff that you love doing. So thanks very much for asking me, and hopefully I've kind of got that across.
Thanks again, Finley, for coming on the show. You can check out his FKT report on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and see his art and read his fantastic blog on gomountaingoats.com. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, this is Heather on the FKT Podcast.